Okay. Good morning, everyone. We'll go ahead and get started. My name is Brian Keller, and I'm a technical evangelist for Microsoft. My focus is on our Visual Studio ALM capabilities. Did anyone make it to the foundational session that I gave with Brian Harry early in the week? Great, you came back, so that's a good sign. Good to see you all again. So if you didn't catch that foundational session, in that foundational session, we gave about a 70-minute preview of what's coming in Visual Studio 2013 and Team Foundation Server 2013. So we're excited. We'll be releasing a preview of that later this month at the Build Conference. So you'll be able to download that June 26th, and that will have a go-live license with it. And we have announced that we'll be releasing Visual Studio 2013 to production later this calendar year. In this session, I'm primarily going to be focusing on what we shipped in 2012 with respect to Microsoft Test Manager and Lab Management. Quick show of hands, how many people already use Microsoft Test Manager? Okay, fair number of you. Keep your hands up if you are already on 2012. Okay. How many people have used Lab Management in the past? Usually not too many people. All right, brave souls here. If I had a t-shirt, I'd give it away. For those of you that are already using Microsoft Test Manager, hopefully in this session I'll be able to show you something new or maybe share some of the best practices that I have with respect to how to use Microsoft Test Manager in kind of an agile manner. For those of you that are brand new, we're going to start from ground zero, assuming that you know nothing about Microsoft Test Manager, and we'll quickly work our way up from there. I make all of my virtual machines available online, so you can go to that link at the top and you can download. I currently have three virtual machines. The one in the top is the one I'll be using today, so this is kind of a general Visual Studio 2012 update to ALM virtual machine. You can download that. It's a Hyper-V virtual machine. You can set it up, and I have something like 25 hands-on labs that you can run through, demo scripts, that sort of thing. So a big part of my job is making sure that if I can get you excited here, that when you go back to your desks and you get ready to start playing with this, that you can actually get a good hands-on experience. Because if you just install Visual Studio and Team Foundation Server, it's kind of an empty canvas. So part of what I've tried to do here is light it up with some sample data and projects and that sort of thing so that you can see the way that a real team might actually start to adopt it. The other two virtual machines, just out of interest, the second one here is the integration between Team Foundation Server and Project Server. So if you find yourself working on a team where you need to report status from a development and a testing team back to kind of a central PMO office, Project Server and TFS provide a native out-of-the-box integration experience for that. And then likewise, the final virtual machine down here shows the integration between System Center and TFS. And that's a nice experience if you run System Center to monitor your production systems. In the foundational session, I showed how you can trigger an alert in System Center and have that flow all the way back to the engineering team so that as a developer, when you pick that up, you should have everything at your fingertips, at least that SCOM already knows about the running application, so that you can quickly dive in and, of course, turn around a fix. I've written a couple of books too. People ask. I hate, plugging my books up here, but people do ask. So the one on the left is really designed for the entire team. So it goes from architecture to dev to test. And then the one on the right is really focused on if you're the TFS administrator and you need to set up TFS, make customizations, that sort of thing. That's what it's designed for. And they have them here in the bookstore as well. So let's talk about testing. I always like to start with a few kind of, well, I guess they're funny now, examples. So this is the USS Yorktown. It was one of the first of the U.S. Navy's smart ships. And when you have a project name like Smart Ship that something has just got to go wrong, and something did for these poor guys. They were sailing out on one of the first voyages of the Smart Ship, and unfortunately, a crew member entered a zero in a text box, and it caused a divide by zero error that actually shut down the propulsion of the ship. So they were dead in the water for something like 3 hours. I'd hate to be the poor seaman that entered the zero in the text box. I'd really hate to be the tester that was supposed to test that test case. We'll pick on Europe for a minute. This is the Ariane 5. This was a really expensive mistake. They actually reused a lot of code from the Ariane 4. Generally speaking, code reuse is good. It worked for Ariane 4, right? But unfortunately, they took a different flight path, and it caused some kind of divide overflow, and this rocket ship exploded. Fortunately, nobody was killed, but it was about $500 million mistake. If you like these examples, by the way, there's a great presentation from a few years ago at OSCON called An Illustrated History of Failure. The presenter goes through and he attempts to quantify the value of a human life, and he divides the GDP by the number of population and multiplies by number of working years. And so everyone's life on average has a value of about $2 million contributed to GDP. And due to the magic of software, we live in a time now where you can, with one line of code, eradicate the value of your entire life and thousands of your peers. So congratulations. This is one that I actually discovered about a year ago. This is the Vasa sailing ship. Has anyone been to Stockholm? It's fascinating, isn't it? You can go to this museum, and they have this almost perfectly preserved boat that actually sank, I think it was the 1700s. It sank about one nautical mile outside of port. And what happened was, if you see at the top, there's this extra row of cannons. The king really wanted to make this kind of the flagship of the Navy at the time. And so he asked to have this extra row of cannons added. Unfortunately, what they forgot to do was revisit the spec and actually expand the ballast down below. So basically, the entire ship was top heavy. And what that resulted in was, when they sailed out and they caught their first batch of wind, it kind of knocked the whole thing over. Unfortunately, about 17 people did die on that, but Sweden got a great museum out of the experience. The real kicker here was that QA was ignored, because they actually tested this. They had sailors on the top deck run from left to right, back and forth, and the person running the test said, "We have to stop the test because we're going to sink the boat." So they knew this thing was top heavy, and they sailed it anyway. So unfortunately, we're still learning those lessons today. Of course, I do work at Microsoft, so I would be remiss if I didn't talk about some of our bugs. This is a product that I worked on. I'm not exactly sure how you would go about closing that, for sure. This file is still copying. We've all been there. An error has occurred while displaying the error that has occurred while creating an error report. Perfectly fine, except they're missing a period back here, right? And you can't argue with this one. Okay. So we're all in this together, right? Software quality, boat quality, rocket quality, we all need to come together to make quality a part of everything that we do. So how do we do that? And so I'm just going to tell you quickly the story of how Microsoft got into the business of building Microsoft Test Manager and kind of the vision that we had. So a few years back, we took a look at the software development lifecycle, and I like to compare it to something that I love to do, which is rock climbing. And in the winter, when it's rainy in Seattle, 13 months out of the year, I spent a lot of the time in the training gym. And the cost of failure at that time is actually quite low. You might jam your finger, you're out of the gym for a few days, no big deal, right? But by the time you're out and you're actually doing an expedition, and here's my very first glacier summit, and you can really see how steep it was, several hundred feet down on either side, you really want to make sure that you've tested yourself and your gear and your team and everything that goes with the expedition, because the cost of failure is quite high at that point. And so software, really, it's the same way, right? For years, Microsoft has been giving you Visual Studio to help you find bugs in your code before you even compile them. And if we can tell you that a unit test is failing, then maybe that is going to cost you 20 minutes of your time. Worst case scenario, you go back to the last known build. But by the time you ship that software out to your customers, it's a much more expensive mistake. Not only are your customers upset and you have to kind of make them happy, but the person who shipped that code and built it, maybe is no longer even at the company. So we knew that we were doing a pretty good job here. Customers are telling us they love Visual Studio, but we also wanted to try to address this middle space. So what can we do to really improve that test portion of the life cycle? And so what we did is we took a look at the entire testing ecosystem. And at the far right end of the spectrum, you have people that are writing automated tests. Maybe these are unit tests, they're load tests. It's writing code that tests other code. At the far left end of the spectrum, you have people that wake up every day and they put their user hat on and they try to use the software by running through a set of test cases and trying to break things. And so as it turns out, about 70% of the testing takes place at the left end of the spectrum. And so you might look at this and say, well, one thing we could do is try to move more of the testing over to the right. But the reality is that the reason that manual testers exist is that they're much smarter than automated tests. And they can look at an application and say, you know what, that just doesn't look right. Or, you know what, this test case needs to change because the application behavior changed yesterday. It's not really a bug. Let me just update the test case. So we feel like manual testing is here to stay, and manual testers are very good at their jobs. The problem is that at the far right end of the spectrum, this is where the majority of the tools on the market target people that are writing unit tests and load tests and what have you. And so we felt like the left end of the spectrum, a lot of these guys and gals are underserved. They're using, you know, Word documents and Excel to track their test cases. And so we really wanted to come out with a first-class set of tooling that targeted that left end of the spectrum. Finally, we also saw another opportunity here, which is by taking a look at what happens when a tester finds a bug and goes to the developer. Usually the first response is something like this, right? We've all been there, we're all guilty, we've probably been on both sides of it, and what happens here is that chances are the tester really did find a bug, and chances are it really does work on the developer's machine, but there's some kind of an impedance mismatch between what the tester was doing. Maybe they interpreted the test case differently from the developer, maybe they're running a different set of, you know, operating system and service pack and browser configuration. Whatever the case may be, this needs to result in a conversation between the developer and the tester. And this oftentimes is a huge area of waste within organizations, especially if your development team is in a different location than your testing team, because oftentimes that can just add to the length of that conversation. And unfortunately, a lot of these bugs get resolved as no repro, which means you're guaranteed that your customer will find them, right? And so we felt like we could do better. We felt like we could build a set of tools that could help automatically capture some of this information so that by the time the tester found a bug and filed it to the developer, it was an actionable bug. You had a lot more information in that bug to tell the developer exactly what might be happening. And so for most of the rest of the time, I'm going to be spending it in demonstrations here. Just one more slide here. For folks that aren't yet using Microsoft Test Manager, it does plug right in with Team Foundation Server. You can use Team Foundation Service on the back end, which is our cloud-hosted version of Team Foundation Server. Great way to get started. Go to tfs.visualstudio.com to get set up with that. And so everything that I'll be showing you today actually does work with Team Foundation Service. Okay, let's jump into some demos here. So this is Microsoft Test Manager, and it would help if I plugged in my mouse. Microsoft Test Manager, like I said, was built from the ground up, primarily with manual testers in mind. And so on the left-hand side here, you'll see a list of requirements. And so each one of these requirements is what we call a requirements-based suite, and that maps back to a requirement that the dev team is actively working on during this sprint. And the way that I got this list of requirements is I just queried Team Foundation Server, and I pulled in that list of requirements. I'm going to use the term requirement here, but if you're using user stories or features, whatever that work item type is that you use in TFS to describe the type of work that you're going to be producing on the dev team, you can map that over to Microsoft Test Manager. Over on the right-hand side, you'll see a list of test cases. And so these test cases are going to, of course, be linked back to those features, and they just validate that, you know, users can go through the expected behavior. You can do this, you can't do this. If you do receive this, you know, you'll get an error dialog, that sort of thing. And so if we take a look at one of these test cases, then you'll notice down here that we have a list of test steps. For those of you that are already using Team Foundation Server, this is just a work item. So a test case is a work item, and that's very much by design. Because Team Foundation Server takes this concept that says the more data we get into the system, the smarter we can be about giving you information to build better software. And so your test cases get linked back to your requirements. Your requirements can then be linked back to builds. So you can say, for example, that this requirement was implemented in that build, and these five test cases validate that requirement, and three of them are failing. So that's the type of information we want to give back to you as a team so you can make smarter decisions. For the most part, this is just a flat text list of test steps. But down here at the bottom, you'll notice that we can also parameterize this as well. And so here you can see that I have a column called new quantity. The way that I got that new quantity field was just to add this Twitter style syntax and say at new quantity, and it automatically added that column for me. And so rather than have to maintain multiple test cases for multiple sets of data, shipping to US addresses and Canadian addresses, I can just write the test case once, maintain it in one place, and data bind that. The other nice thing about this approach is that I can go back and create a coded UI test with this later on. I'll show you how to do that. And it will also drive that coded UI test, which is a fully automated test using the values that you put into this field. And so the nice thing about that is that a manual tester who may or may not be technical can just drop into the test case. They don't have to touch any of the coded UI test at that point, and they can maintain the list of parameter values that you want to test with. Okay? So let's run our first test. We have this test case 41, and if I move to the test tab, this is where the tester is going to come in each morning to figure out what they need to test. And you'll notice a couple of things going on. First of all, you'll notice that test case I just showed you is actually listed twice. The reason it's listed twice is over here on the configuration column. We are actually defining that each one of these test cases needs to be run against multiple configurations. Maybe it's operating system or browser or service pack level. And the idea is that you can apply that to all of the test cases in your plan. You can also override that for specific test cases. A good example of when you might override it for a specific test case is if you know that the particular test you're running is just back-end server logic and has no bearing on the actual browser that's being used, whether it's IE, Firefox, Chrome. You can save your test team some time by just running that test once and then removing the other two configurations. So I'll show you how to do that in a minute. The other thing you'll notice, of course, here is that these test results show up. So for these particular test cases, you can see that the last time I ran them, they passed or failed. We can also get all of the history for these by just opening one and clicking on View Results, and that would show me all of my historical test runs. So we'll take this test case, and we'll click on Run. I could multi-select if I wanted to. And at this point, this opens up the Microsoft Test Runner. The Test Runner is responsible for a few things. Number one, of course, it just shows me what test steps I need to run. It allows me to report on the pass-fail of each one of those test steps. But probably the most important job of Test Runner is that once I kicked off this test, it started collecting rich data in the background. So I'll show you a list of the types of data that you can collect in the background. But as an example, we can capture video recordings, event logs, all of that information that's going to make it much easier when you find a bug to hand it off to the developer and for them to understand, oh, OK, I get it. I see what the tester did, or I see the event log. I understand the problem. The other thing that Test Runner can do is it can actually capture the actions that you perform when you're testing the application, and you can use that to fast forward through your test case later on. Now, this isn't full automation. It still requires a manual tester to sit in front of the screen at a minimum and inspect to ensure that everything is going right. But the idea is that if I have a 20-step test case that every day I have to run and, you know, create a new user account, the next few steps are adding five items to my shopping cart, then I'm checking out, and really today I'm just validating like the sub total on the, you know, shopping cart page is correct. We want to save that tester some time by letting them fast forward through those sets of actions. And so here you can see that it's just asking me to validate that the quantity reverts to one, and we can pass that, and then just for fun we'll just hit play to finish off this test case. Everybody always asks now, you know, what types of applications that works with. It works really well on web applications, in Internet Explorer. In a coded UI test, you can actually play back an action recording against Chrome and Firefox. You can't do that as part of the automated action recording playback within Microsoft Test Runner. So there is a matrix on MSDN that describes all the different platforms that we support for this playback mechanism. Most Microsoft stacks work really well, WPF, Silverlight 5. So I always tell people just try it. Your mileage may vary just depending on the types of controls you're working with. So we'll just abort this test run because I want to show you what's one of the most important aspects of Microsoft Test Manager, which is that data collection that we do in the background. So I came back to the Plan tab, I went to Properties, and then down here at the bottom we have this Test Settings area. And when I open up the test settings, this allows me to define exactly what information I'm capturing off of the application that I'm testing. Now, in this particular example, I'm only testing with a single machine, my local virtual machine here. But if you were testing an interior application, you might have a back-end web server and a SQL server and your local client machine. And if you have that environment, you can define that as a multi-machine environment. And you'll see across the top that you'll get multiple machines, and you can set the test settings for each one of those machines. As an example, off of the client machine, I probably want to capture a video recording. Off of the web server, if I'm running ASP.NET, an IntelliTrace file might be helpful. So this is an important job for the testers and the developers to work together so that the developer really gets to participate in defining what set of information might be helpful to capture. You can also write your own custom test settings as well. So if you have an application which spits a log file out to some machine on the hard drive, rather than forcing the test team to always remember, right, I have to go grab that log file, you can just write a custom test setting and plug that right in, and it will go fetch that at the end of the test run, or at the beginning, or whenever you need to fetch it. A couple of these we'll talk about later. I just wanted to point out a few examples. I mentioned IntelliTrace. If you haven't yet used IntelliTrace, IntelliTrace is extremely helpful for helping you diagnose .NET application failures. You can actually go back in time and kind of rewind the call stack. And what we do is we capture interesting events along the way. So every time we make an ADO.NET call, we grab a snapshot of the stack, and we also tell you what exactly that ADO.NET call was. Every time there's an exception that's thrown or caught, we also capture the stack. And so IntelliTrace files are really useful for being able to go back and understand exactly what's going on. The one challenge with these is that they do tend to be very verbose, and you can have IntelliTrace files that, you know, quickly become multiple gigs. And so they're helpful. I suggest that you turn them on to capture that level of detail. But as a TFS administrator, you should be aware of that. And as part of the TFS power tools, you can download a test attachments cleaner that you can run and say, clean up all of the IntelliTrace files from last iteration, or all of the video recordings from, you know, two iterations ago. Video recordings do tend to be fairly small, about a meg per minute of recording. There's some interesting things you can do with a video recording. Obviously, it's useful if a test case fails, but you can also save a video recording if a test case passes. I've seen lots of teams use this for agile documentation. So if you want to see the way that a particular feature was working in last night's build, rather than go install that build yourself, if the test team has already run through that test pass, you can just open up that video recording. The other nice thing about this is that if you outsource your testing, you can go back and audit to make sure that the people that you're paying to test your software are actually running those test cases properly. You can also have multiple test settings. And so I mentioned that the IntelliTrace files actually take a lot of space. They also do have a performance cost as well, because the way that IntelliTrace works, we actually rejit the application, which means that we go back and recompile it, and we insert several points within the .NET code that actually tell the execution engine to spit out this log file anytime any of these events happen. And so it's probably not something you want to run all of the time. What I suggest is that you maintain at least two test settings, one that's kind of lightweight, and then one that gives you full diagnostics. And then if you find a bug, you can go back and capture a repro of that bug using IntelliTrace, and you can actually file that set of attachments back to the original bug, and it will just keep getting richer so that by the time the developer picks it up, hopefully they have everything that they need. So I've shown you how to run a test case. I've showed you how to author a test case and how to configure the way that test cases get run. The next problem that we wanted to solve in Microsoft Test Manager was to help test teams understand when do I pick up a new build? You know, if you look at the typical Agile team these days, most teams are generating continuous integration builds. So during the course of a day, you might have 10, 20, 50 different builds coming out. And as a test team, it can oftentimes become very frustrating to try to understand which build is worth my time to pick up. And oftentimes, a tester will go talk to a developer and, did you check in that feature yet? Did you check in that bug fix? But as it turns out, Team Foundation Server actually already has that information in it. So we can surface that to you as long as the developers are associating those work items when they check in that code. And so that's an important thing to make sure that you're doing, because when you do, and you come over to the Track tab, you can assign a build. And you'll see here that at the top, I'm currently using this build 318.3. I can see that a new build is available, 318.4. And then down below, I see a list of all the things that have changed between the last build and the current build. And so here I see that a particular task was updated, maybe some regular expressions were authored. That doesn't necessarily have any immediate bearing on my test plan, so I'm going to skip this build. Next, I might come and look at the latest build in here, and you'll notice that a few things have changed. Number one, we've had a bug that's actually been marked as resolved, and the practice we follow on my team is that if a developer says they've resolved a bug, it's up to the tester to actually close that out, verifying that they can't repro it anymore. So that gives me something new to test. We also have this new user story, which is resolved as well, and so maybe I was waiting for this user story to be checked in so that I could go run some new tests. So at this point, I know that this build appears to be worth my time, so I'm going to assign it to my test plan. That's going to send a signal to the rest of my team that we have a new build. We'll go install it and get that all ready. The next question I want to answer, though, is I have some new things to test, but over the last week, while we were using the old build, we ran 1,000 test cases, and 90% of them passed. And so we're getting a new build. Chances are something's going to break that was working last week, but where do I even start? And so to help you answer that question, we included a piece of technology called Test Impact Analysis right within Microsoft Test Manager. And so when you're running your test cases, if you turn on the test setting list that I showed you earlier for Test Impact Analysis, we can actually keep track of which code is executed as you're running each test case. So I'm running test case 51. We ended up touching these three .NET classes. And on this particular class, we executed these five methods. Developer comes along, checks in some code, which changes this particular method. And then we trace that back to the source. And we say, test case 51 passed last time, but you might want to consider rerunning it. Now, the next thing I'm going to say is important. It doesn't mean that it's going to fail. It also doesn't mean that if a test is not impacted, that it's necessarily going to continue to pass, because there could be other parts of the test environment or pieces of native code that we just can't trace which have changed, which require you to retest it. But what it does tell me is that if I have, an hour before lunch and I want to test the test cases which TFS thinks have the highest probability of failing or being impacted, this is the list that I should start with. And so when I pick, when I pick this this build, it comes back and says some tests have been impacted. Consider rerunning these tests. And when I view these recommended tests, I can just highlight them, reset them to active. And now when I revisit the test tab, you'll notice that these particular test cases are active, which is a signal to the rest of my team that we don't know if they're going to pass or fail. We should try rerunning them. Okay? Any questions so far? Yes?
Is there any way to mark the build as testable if you are creating 23 builds?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think what you're asking is whether or not you can go back and set a status on a build. And yes, you can. So when you go to the build definitions, you can apply these filters. And so you can say, for example, where is it? I haven't done this in a while, sorry. There is a place that you can, here it is. So you can set a build filter on quality so that maybe somebody on your team is responsible for scouting that build, and you can indicate to the rest of the team, you know what, this build's not even worth your time. It's failing on install. Don't even bother. So yeah, good question. Yeah. So his question was whether or not the test impact analysis would actually be impacted, would be able to register whether or not JavaScript code has been impacted. If you have just loose JavaScript code, we won't pick that up. If you have methods that are dynamically spitting out JavaScript code, then we would pick this up. So really, it has to flow through .NET. So yeah, good question. Are there options to not save all the test results in TFS? Is your question whether or not you can abandon a test result or whether or not you can save them somewhere else? Okay. And why wouldn't you want to save those results? Okay, so, right. So I think your concern is just about the amount of size that it takes up. Yeah, I mean, really, unless you're collecting those IntelliTrace files, the amount of size that it takes up on the server is going to be quite minimal. So you can, of course, go back and you can delete old test results if you want to, or you can choose just not to save those test results. But there's not really a way, unless you just run the test result and just abort that test run, that we're not going to at least try to save some information to TFS. So yeah. Okay. Sorry, in the back. Yes. No, you're not missing anything. Most of the information that surfaces along the lines of test results does show up within Microsoft Test Manager. I'm going to show you in a minute some of the tooling that we've introduced in the web in TFS 2013 that allows you to see some of that information from the web. There are some licensing implications we can talk about offline, but yes, we're trying to make sure that that's available. That type of information should be available anywhere, whether or not you have MTM installed. Okay, if I don't see you, please yell out. These lights are really bright, but I don't think there's anything else. So we'll move on to agile testing or exploratory testing. Does anybody practice exploratory testing today? Does anybody maybe not know what exploratory testing is? So exploratory testing is basically the idea of getting into an application and testing it using what you know as a tester without actually starting with a test case. If you're delivering a government contract for NASA, you need to have test cases. You've signed up to deliver on XYZ functionality, and if you don't meet those requirements, then you're going to have to pay a penalty or something along those lines. But oftentimes, there's a whole other set of bugs that we can find by just jumping into the application and trying to break things. And so this is an increasingly popular movement. I like to refer to him as the grandfather of exploratory testing is a gentleman named James Whitaker. He actually was an architect on Microsoft Test Manager. He was at Google for a while, ran a large testing organization there. Now he's back at Microsoft, and he writes some excellent books on exploratory testing, and he basically talks about different approaches that you can use, and he has this concept of charters and tours. So if you're going to go on vacation to Italy and you have one day to spend, you'll open up the guidebook and it says go to the Colosseum and the Forum and go check out this winery, right? But if you maybe have a week to spend, then everyone in this room might go off and do different things. Maybe, Kristen does a back alley tour, and someone else wants to go check out, small churches and that kind of thing. And by having these charters, then you can actually go explore all these different paths that you might not otherwise think to explore if you had to restrain yourself to writing test cases. Now, there's a couple of criticisms with exploratory testing. Number one is that they oftentimes tend to result in bad bugs. And what I mean by that is that if you're just clicking through an application and trying to break something, you might not remember what the 20 steps were that you did leading up to breaking that particular application. The other challenge with exploratory testing is that as a manager who's running a test team, you may not understand the ROI that you're getting by letting your testers go out and do exploratory testing for a week. Were they updating their Facebook status, or were they actually going out and finding bugs? And so we've tried to address both of those criticisms and really embrace exploratory testing right within Microsoft Test Manager 2012. And so I already showed you how you can run a test case. But if we wanted to do exploratory testing, we actually don't start with a test case. We just go to this Do Exploratory Testing tab. We click on Explore, and then this is going to launch Test Runner. So it's going to start capturing that rich data in the background, but it's not going to show me a test case because, of course, at this point, it's up to the tester to start testing the application. And so I'll start testing. I'll browse over to my Fabricam site. And I'm just going to click around Fabricam a little bit just to simulate what would happen if you're, in the application testing for, say, 45 minutes or so. And so I'll check out a few records. And again, in the background, it's capturing all that information about what I clicked on and what I'm doing. We'll just generate a little bit of traffic here. And so far, this looks pretty good. Everything looks great. But then let's go down a different rabbit hole. I'll click on delete and see what happens. And I noticed down here that we don't have a customer or a created by. These data values were on the previous page, so I know that I found a bug. And so I'm going to capture this bug just by giving a screenshot to the developer. And I'll create a bug based on this. Delete page is missing values. And then down here, you'll see that while I was testing, we actually generated these nice little snapshot thumbnails for you that show exactly what I clicked on. And so this is not only a reminder to the tester, but it's also helpful for the developer to see exactly what path they followed. But this could be overwhelming, especially if I was in this test case for this exploratory testing session for 45 minutes before I found a bug. So what you can do is you can click on Change Steps. And as a tester, I can scope this list of actions down to the ones that I think are most relevant to that bug that I found. And so now when I do that, it's going to scope that down. Keep in mind that if you do need to get access to this as a developer, you can still access the parent test run, and you can get the entire 45-minute session if that's what the tester was doing. But by default, we're going to try to make it easy for the developer, and we'll go ahead and file this as a bug. And the other thing that we want to do here is create a test case. Because I happened to go down this particular rabbit hole one morning and found this bug, and hopefully the development team is going to fix it and turn around a fix. But then in 2 weeks, if we happen to regress that feature, this is actually pretty important. So I want to make sure that we formally test that. And so this allows you to blend the approach of formal and exploratory testing. So I can say make sure delete page has correct values. And for those of you that are using Test Manager 2010, this is, believe it or not, our number one feature request was rich text in here. Do not click confirm. Make that red. I know, rich text demo. Love it. And so when you save this, it's now going to put you back into the exploratory testing run. You can go through and generate new bugs, new test cases. And then once you're done, you can end that testing. And so now this is the test results for the entire exploratory test session that I showed you or that I talked about. So I can see all the bugs, all the test cases that were generated as a result of this. And this is the way that you can go back to management and show the value of exploratory testing, because you can say, hey, I was in here for 10 minutes, and I already generated one bug and one test case. Yeah?
How different is this to
the one? So he's referring to the feedback client. So in 2012, I haven't shown it this morning, but we shipped a feedback client that you can use to request feedback from external stakeholders. And the idea is that you might say, you know, hey, does this particular employee page meet your expectations? And when they run that that feedback client, it's going to launch a tool that looks very similar to what I just showed you with Microsoft Test Runner, and it can capture video recordings, screenshots, and audio annotations in the background. So it's similar in that respect, but you cannot use that to generate a formal bug. What it does is it generates a feedback response that a team might turn into a bug. You also can't use that to generate a test case. But you're right to notice the comparison, because under the hood, it's actually the same set of code that we've just branched. No, it doesn't generate those action recordings either. Good question. Mm-hmm. Where was that? Over here? Or you mean as part of the? Regardless of where the UI is, yes. If you call bugs on your team widgets, you can map that in TFS so that a widget is now what you refer to as a bug. Does that answer your question? Yeah, it's funny the religious battles you see. Oh, we're not going to call them bugs. They're defects or they're issues or whatever. Yeah.
Can you do recordings of other applications?
Sure. Yeah, so that's a good question. I'm glad you asked that. So his question was, can you record other types of applications? I've been showing browser applications. And the answer is your mileage may vary depending on the level of data capture and depending on the type of application. So with a web application, I can capture, obviously, a video recording and an action recording, and I can play that back against the web application. And you can also generate those test steps as well. If you're testing a third-party application framework like Java, then we probably won't have the accessibility hooks that we need in order to get all of that information, but you could certainly capture a video recording. You could certainly record the results of the test cases. You could capture event logs in the background. So there is an article on MSDN that describes the different levels of data capture that you get. If you can't, it's kind of hard to find, so send me an email if you can't find it. But the general recommendation I have is just to try it, because you might have a WPF application and 90% of it works great, but you might find that there's a third-party control that doesn't work correctly, and so you just won't be able to get the data when you're on that particular path of the application. Yeah. Would UX designers use this to review behaviors and UI testing? What do you mean by UI testing? Just inspecting the application, make sure everything looks good? Yeah, you could. Sure, certainly. Yeah, I would consider them a form of tester. So sure, there's no reason that they couldn't use that tool. Yep. And there was another hand. Yeah.
In the beginning, you were showing what type of log files or red logs that you can test.
Yeah, so his question is, in order for you to capture this information, what type of access is required on those servers? And it would depend on the type of data that you're trying to capture. I believe that an event log, for example, does not require administrative privileges. I could be wrong about that, but I believe that most event log data does not require you to be a super user on the box. System information, certainly anybody could capture that. Microsoft Test Manager runs as the user that's logged in. If you're going to capture information off of other machines, then you install test agents on those machines. I'll talk a little bit more about that in the lab management section. And when you install those test agents, they run as a user that you specify. So you could specify an administrative user or a low privileges user if you wanted to. Sure. Yeah. So, Sure, certainly you could. So when I converted that to a test case, I could have gone back and said, you know, hey, before you actually get here, you need to launch the web application, something like that. Yeah, you can annotate that. Yes. Can it be used with any third-party bug tracking system? In general, we're using TFS to capture everything. Now, there are bridges for a lot of these tools that allow you to, for example, run Quality Center, capture defects, and push those defects over to TFS. But Microsoft Test Manager is only going to push data to TFS. And if you needed to push those bugs over to Jira, then you could use the Team Foundation integration platform to do that. The TFS integration platform is a tool that we've written with a set of library abstractions that make it easier to get data in and out of TFS and other third-party systems. So I don't believe there's already a provider written for Jira, but you could have a developer write a provider that pushes the data you need. So I'm going to move along just so we stay on track here, but we'll take more questions later. The next thing I'd like to show you is how you might evolve the test case that we were running earlier and turn that into a fully automated test case. And so just to remind you, this is a test case that we ran earlier on. It asks me to go through and change the value of an item on the shopping cart and try to specify like a negative value on there and make sure that when you try to order with a negative value, that we actually revert that back to a positive. Obviously, it wouldn't be a very good business model if we were paying people to shop from us. And so what I would like to do now is take the next step, which is to turn that into a fully automated coded UI test. And so imagine that test case that we were running manually reaches a certain point where it's passing on a regular basis. We feel rather confident that the entire application UI is not going to change in the short term. And we would like to free up those manual testing resources by turning that into a fully automated coded UI test. And so with Visual Studio, you can file new project, select your language, go to test project type, and select a coded UI test project. And there's two types of approaches to creating these coded UI tests. One is to use the existing action recording that the manual tester already recorded and use that as the basis to convert that into C# code or Visual Basic code. The other approach is to use the action recorder that's included as part of Visual Studio to just get into the application and start recording those actions yourself. I'll show you a blend of both approaches. So here I'm going to start with that action recording from the test team. And I happen to know that that's work item number 41. But one good thing to think about doing if you want to automate this flow or make this flow a little bit easier is there's a status. Because this is a work item, you can actually flow this status from not automated, which is when you're manually testing it, over to planned automation. And then from there, you can have your dev team query for anything that's planned. And then you can take those planned test cases and turn them into coded UI tests. And so here you can see that I have converted this to code. And you'll see that there's a list of methods. Each one of these methods corresponds to an original test step that was in that test case. But there's a trick to making this work, which is in order for you to have the individual actions correspond to these test steps, you need to make sure that when the tester is recording that action recording, that they're marking that each test step is passing as they're finishing those actions. And that's an important thing to do because it will make it easier later on if you need to maintain this code. And for example, you know, change the way that you click on add to cart. So just a nice thing to do. Otherwise, if you don't do that, you'll just get one big method, which is harder to maintain. So if I was to run this particular test case right now, it would click through the application and then close the browser. And we're not actually doing any validation because, remember, we were relying on the manual tester to inspect the application and make sure that everything looks good. So in order to replace the manual tester sitting in front of the machine, I'll just place my cursor in the middle of the test step, middle of the test case, and we'll use the coded UI test builder to add some additional logic here. I'll open up my application. We'll get it to the point that it's ready to validate. And then down at the bottom, you'll notice that you have this little crosshair, and you can drag this crosshair to validate additional controls. And so when I move around my application, you can see all the different controls that we can validate. And we're just using the Internet Explorer DOM in order to record this. If you do want to record tests and play them back in Chrome or Firefox, you can do that, but you will have to record in IE. That's where the recorder was built to assume that you're recording everything. Do you need to record a test per browser version, like IE9, IE10? No, you can record the test once, and then you can play it back in those other browsers. The only exception is if you're recording HTML5 functionality, you know, then you would need a modern browser. And so this just gives me a property bag showing me all the different values that I can validate. And you can add multiple assertions here. We'll just select one. Another nice thing to do that we added in 2012 is this assertion failure message. And so when you get in the morning and you're looking at a build that has all these test failures on it, it can become frustrating if you're looking at a failed coded UI test and all it says is that this particular control did not match, you know, the value of 5. And so here is where you can help the testers who are validating those test results by saying, you know, quantity didn't revert properly or something like that. And we'll just add that to the test failure message. I could add other assertions now if I wanted to. We'll just generate that code and say, you know, make sure quant equals 1. Clean up my browser, put my application back, and then we should be able to run this. So this should run 3 times because there's 3 different rows in that test parameter's value. And you'll notice there at the top that it's already bound to the test case as a data source. So when a tester goes back and adds an additional value to that column, you run the test again, then it will run with those values. So this is obviously a coded UI test running on my local machine. In a few minutes, we're going to take this coded UI test and we're going to run it on a remote machine as part of a lab management environment. So those of you that are new to lab management, we'll just quickly introduce that. Lab management is a capability that we introduced in 2010, and it's really designed to help you set up these build, deploy, test workflows, where you might be building your code and you need to spin up one or more environments. Maybe you have one environment that uses, SQL Server 2008, but you also need to test your code against SQL 2012, so those might be different environments. Maybe you have different environments with different versions of browsers and so on. And then when you spin up those environments, you can then take your code. You can push that down to the running environment. Lab management will handle that for you. And you then can start running your tests against that environment and reporting the results. So you might run this several times a day. You might run this, you know, once a night, depending on the complexity of the test. And you get in the morning and you find out that, hey, you know, we introduced a change last night which broke SQL Server, our application running on SQL Server 2008. And this is just a quick architecture diagram. I don't want to get into a ton of detail on this, but I did just want to mention that there's 2 different types of environments now. In 2010, we introduced this thing called an SCVMM environment. So System Center has a great product for helping you manage labs of virtual machines. And we built our solution in 2010 on top of that environment so that when you kick off a test run, if you wanted to, you could provision a brand new clean machine from the library. We will specify a machine name and an amount of system RAM. We'll spin up that environment. Once we deploy the build out to it, we can snapshot that entire environment so you can at any time go back to Friday night's build before you've run any of your tests, and then you can shut down that environment once you're done. That is a great workflow if you have the resources and the expertise to set up and maintain an SCVMM environment. A lot of organizations don't. You know, I might just be running with Windows 8 as my primary developer desktop, but maybe several times a day I want to push my code out to a Windows Server VM that's running under my desk and just make sure that everything, you know, kind of looks good from that perspective. I don't want to set up and maintain a System Center Virtual Machine Manager infrastructure for that scenario. Or you might find that, you know, you can't use the system requirements that we have for SCVMM because we do require you to have SCVMM and Hyper-V. lot of organizations are embracing Hyper-V now, but you might have a corporate standard to use VMware, for example. That's why we introduced the standard environment over here. The standard environment allows you to point to any machine, and you just need network access and admin credentials to initially install the test agent on that machine. And once you point to that machine, we will configure it to participate in this workflow as part of your lab managed environment. And then you can easily kick off a build, and then a few minutes later, it's going to push your code out to that machine or to multiple machines in the environment, run all your tests, and then if something fails, of course, you can connect to it and see what's going on. There are some trade-offs that you don't get when you go to standard environments, which is you don't get this automatic ability to do things like snapshot and restore. You also, with SCVMM environments, can do what's called network fencing, where you literally set up identical copies of machines that might have the same IP and the same machine name as your production machines, and we handle the network fencing for you so that you isolate those environments, but you can still run all of your test cases as if they're still the same machine names as in production. But standard environments are the quickest way to get started with lab management, and you can always graduate up from there if you'd like to. So I'll show you just a basic example of a standard environment. So bear in mind I'm running everything on my laptop here, so I've got multiple virtual machines, and it's a little bit slow, but we'll make it work. And so here you can see that I have the same... Yeah. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. You didn't miss anything. I was just starting up my VMs. Okay, so we spent all of our time until now in the testing center. I'll just switch over to the lab center. I'll just quickly revert this here. This is the one challenge of this demo, is it takes a little while to get things set up. But what I have here is I have a different virtual machine that's running on my same box. It could be on a different box, of course. And you'll see that I've already installed the test agent over here. And there's two different ways to install the test agent. One is just to install it as a regular service. It can run in the background. It can execute your unit tests, for example. But most of the time, when people do this, they're actually running this as a continuous integration with coded UI tests. And when you run a coded UI test, the agent assumes that it has control of your mouse and keyboard. And so in order to do that, you need to run it as an interactive process. And I'll show you where that gets configured as well. Okay, so this is my environment. It consists of a single machine. It could consist of as many machines as you'd like. In order to set up this environment, I created a new environment here, and I defined the machines that I needed. Here's where I specified the administrative credentials that are required for that particular machine. And then down here at the bottom, this is where I specified that that agent needs to run as an interactive process. And again, I specified the name of the user that it needs to run in as. Of course, if you needed to simulate multiple users, maybe one that's an administrator, one that is a lower level person on the machine, you could do that and just set up multiple environments. In order to make this work, I also have a test case. And this test case started its life as a manual test. And we graduated it to an automated test by writing a coded UI test. You upload that coded UI test in a Team Foundation server, and then you can go into Visual Studio, open up that test case, and associate that test case with automation. And so, as an example, you might decide that in order to automate this test case, you want to use a unit test, or you want to use a coded UI test, or even a web performance test or a load test. Whatever you want to use to automate that is an option available for you. And then when you run this build, deploy, test workflow, we're going to run across all of the test cases in your test plan. We're going to look for any that have test automation built into it, and then we're going to run those against that environment. The way that this all gets strung together is as part of your build definition. And so at a minimum, you usually need two build definitions within Team Foundation Server to set up this build, deploy, test workflow. The first thing you need is just the build definition that's going to compile your project. And so when I set up a build, deploy, test workflow, as part of that process, I specify which build definition is required in order to compile my project. Maybe it's an ASP.NET project, and then we're going to web deploy that somewhere. Maybe we're generating a SQL script. And as part of this build definition, you'll notice that I've selected the lab default template. And that's what gives me the options to define the build, deploy, test workflow. And so within here, there's a lot of parameters, so we gave you a wizard to make it a little easier to set this up. You'll specify your environment name. If I was using an SCVMM-based environment, I could say that the first thing I want to do is reset that environment back to a known good snapshot location. So maybe prior to installing my bits on it, of course, prior to running any of my test cases. But because I'm using a standard environment, that's not an option for me. So it's just up to you to manage the state of your environment yourself. This is where you specify the compilation build that you're going to run. You could point to another build location. So I oftentimes have people ask me, you know, if I'm using Jenkins or Cruise Control, can I use the output of that build for a build deploy test? And the answer is yes. You would just point to the location of the successful build that you want to pull in. And then this is where you specify your deployment logic. And there's no secret sauce here. So if you use a batch file to deploy your builds today, you just come in here and you specify the name of that batch file. You can parameterize it with the different machine names that are in your environment. That's especially helpful if you're using dynamic machine names or different environments that have different machine names, because you can parameterize that so that it knows from the web server, we need to set up the web application in such a way that it knows how to talk to the database, that sort of thing. And finally, what do you want to test? And so this is where I point back to that test plan, and I say, enumerate that test plan and look for any test cases that I might want to run. And at that point, you can just schedule that workflow to run, you know, multiple times a day. You can kick off a build manually, and so we'll do that. We'll kick off a new build. We'll see if my VM's happy now, whether or not it actually runs. If not, it's just, this is a lot of hardware for a single machine. But with any luck, it should kick off this build, and then you'll see the test agent change status and run the test in the background. So while we're waiting for that, does anyone have any more questions? One of the things you may have noticed, yeah. The test case, yeah. Can you move that somewhere else? So just to repeat the question, I showed how you can use a coded UI test, and you can bind that back to TFS, the test case itself. Can you move that somewhere else? And yes, you can. By default, when you pull in those action recordings, we assume that you want to use the information that's in the test case, but you certainly have the option of pointing that to a database, a CSV file, an XML file, and then you can pull that information in from there. Yes, can you use MS Build Actions as part of this workflow? By default, we assume that when you set up a lab management workflow, that you're specifying all of those deployment steps as part of that deployment tab. Certainly, you can call into MS Build if you want to. You can also customize the lab management workflow and just go in there and add the MS Build steps that you want. The one challenge with that is that you would probably need to link up the machine names in that environment by specifying that as a configuration so that the MS Build task knows what the target is. But yes, you can do that. Yeah. I'm sorry, can I? Yeah, that's a great question. So this week we announced that we had reached an agreement to acquire InRelease, and they have a great set of technology that lets you automate the workflow of your releases moving from one environment to another. And that's really a great question because, yes, over time I think you'll see us kind of merging a lot of the capabilities that are currently in lab management with the capabilities that we're acquiring as part of InRelease. Right now, the lab management product provides you with really nice integration when you're doing those SCVMM-based environments, and it's already fully built into TFS. InRelease, of course, does build into TFS as well, but over time you'll see that integration get to be tighter. So as an example of where you might use the two, you might decide that I want to use lab management to set up an environment using SCVMM just to deploy all my SQL Server and my core bits out there, but that I want to manage the workflows into that VM as part of InRelease. So there's probably some hybrid solution options right now, and then over time you'll see us merge a lot of those capabilities. The other thing that, if you missed it on Monday, Scott Guthrie came out and he talked about how we're opening up dev test rights in the cloud using Azure IaaS. And a lot of people ask me whether or not you can use lab management in IaaS. And you certainly can. I'm going to be building some white paper guidance in the coming months that goes into a little bit more detail around how you do that. But basically, Azure IaaS is, for all intents and purposes, just like machines that are running on premises. You might need to use virtual networking to actually make sure that those are part of your corporate domain or open up certain firewall ports so that you can get access to them. But with the dev test rights that most of you already get as an MSDN subscriber, IaaS gives you a great infrastructure to say, hey, we need to scale up multiple machines per day and use different configurations and then shut down those machines when we're ready to, when we're done running our tests. So it's a perfect scenario for that. We do. Yes, we have a Visual Studio booth over in the Solution Center that you can stop by. So this is taking a little longer than I expected. It's my machine's still waking up. I apologize. I did want to touch briefly on a couple of items here that start to light up as you're using all of these different components together. This is Lord Kelvin, of course. He invented the Kelvin scale, and he popularized the phrase, you cannot manage what you cannot measure. And I like to refer to him as the grandfather of TFS. Of course, he has no idea what TFS is. But the idea is that as you're starting to get this data into TFS, you can start to light up lots of additional information. And that information can really help you manage your software projects. And I can't tell you how many dev teams I talk to that you're asking them, if they're not using TFS already, you're asking them basic questions like, hey, was that bug fix checked into last night's build and were the test cases passing? And those are really difficult to answer. There's lots of people, lots of different processes involved with that. But TFS was really built from the ground up to help you address some of these questions. And so to that end, we have a lot of reports that ship out of the box. I'm not going to take you through all of them, but this is my favorite report. I like to call this the Steven Sinofsky report. Steven Sinofsky, as you probably know, shipped Windows 7 and Windows 8 and Office 2010, and they started using TFS to manage all of their work. And so by using TFS, they can actually set up this hierarchy between work items. And as an example, of course, this isn't Windows. This is a fictitious company, but I can look at some of these features as a VP, for example, and I can drill in and start to understand how much of the work has been done. And that's a great stat. You know, most developers you talk to, you ask them how much of the work they've done, and they say they're 80% done. So that matches what I'm seeing here. But then you also want to know, you know, if you're done, like, what's the quality of that? And by using Microsoft Test Manager and some of these automated test solutions, you can start to measure that as well. So I can see that this one's 80% done, and we have three tests, but you know, most of these tests aren't actually passing or haven't been run yet. So I don't really feel that good compared with, you know, what you would normally think when you say you're 80% done with something. The next one down, you don't have any tests. And so it's just a way for you to kind of communicate across the entire team. Another report that I really like is this one here. So you'll see that at the top, if I am just looking at this burn down chart, I probably feel pretty good about the way my project is progressing. You can see that we're, you know, edging down the number of hours required, and it looks like we're on track to meet our deadlines. But because of the multiple perspectives that TFS offers, I can also look at a report like this that shows me my user story progress. And the blue user stories indicate user stories that are still under active development. The yellow ones or orange ones represent ones that have been signed off by the dev team and now are up to the test team to validate and close out. And so when I look at this graph, I actually don't feel so good about the status of this because we're getting towards the end of our iteration and we haven't gotten to the point that we have large blocks of code that can actually be tested end to end by our testers and our stakeholders. And so this might give me an indication that I need to ask my developers to, you know, stop doing a little bit of work over here and spreading it all over the place, but instead really focus on closing a user story or two that we can actually hand off with high confidence at the end of the iteration. And I'll leave these in my slide deck. There's also a link here if you want to get started with Team Foundation Service. On Monday, right after the keynote, we actually turned on a lot of brand new capabilities. So one of the ones that we didn't show on Monday, but I'd like to show you now, is that you can, with TFS 2013 and with Team Foundation Service, this gets to the gentleman's question in the back, you can actually open up a web-based view of your test cases. So from this web-based view, I can come in and manage all of my test cases. I can edit the test steps. I can also run the test cases directly from the web. Now, the one drawback here is that when you're running from the web, we won't have the full rich set of information that Microsoft Test Manager gets. So you won't capture IntelliTrace files and video recordings and so on. However, if you just need to move to a non-Windows operating system and validate that a few tests are working on a Mac browser, for example, this gives you a way to do that. You know, if you're working at home and you don't have Microsoft Test Manager installed and you want to check to make sure that everything's on track, this gives you a good way to do that. So the way you get this capability is you just go into Team Foundation Server web access, either on the service or with TFS 2013, and you click at the top on this test tab, and that gives you access to that. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, it's a good question. So just to paraphrase, is it better for him to send all the non-technical people to the web or to use Team Explorer in tandem? And I would say it depends on the functionality that you're looking for. You know, certainly the rich client is going to give you more functionality, more things you can do in there than you would get access to from the web. But over time, we're going to be bringing more and more of those capabilities into the web. There are also some capabilities in the web that are unique to the web. And so, for example, for those of you that missed the foundational session on Monday, we showed how these backlogs can be managed, and you can start to plan and break down work across your entire team, and you can drop into a particular iteration, and you can then decompose that work into individual tasks, and then you can switch over to your modern-day implementation of Post-it notes on a whiteboard, and you can kind of watch this move from left to right. And that was designed specifically for a web-based experience with project managers or scrum masters in mind, and you can't get that functionality in Team Explorer. We're moving to a world where I think you'll see more capabilities in the web over time, but when it comes to testing, as a web application, we just can't get that deep diagnostics information that MTM can give you. Oh, sure. Yeah, if you want to export to Excel, then you'll still need to drop to a Team Explorer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'm following all of your question. Maybe we can hang out for a few minutes after, and we can kind of go through that in detail, because I'm not quite following you, but there are several options for how you can run the test cases in your test plan. We do have a command line that you can run. You can say run through all of the test cases that are automated as part of this. The test manager itself doesn't give you a way to create fully automated tests. You can do that fast forward within a test case, but that doesn't do any validation beyond turning it back over to the manual tester, asking them to, you know, visually inspect the application, and then they can resume that fast forward. So we tried to strike that balance between, you know, when you're manual testing, you sometimes want to semi-automate some steps, but you don't necessarily, you're not yet in a point where the application is going to be stable enough to fully automate it. But I'm not sure I answered your question, so hit me afterwards and we'll chat. Yep. Over here, and then we'll come back. For manual testing, can you reboot in the middle of the test? You can pause your test runs now. So that's a new capability we introduced in 2012. So if you need to pause the test run and then reboot the machine and then come back, you could. Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yep. I'm not sure if you could do that for an automated test. I'd have to think about that. Send me an email and we'll chat. Sure. Over here. Actually, you can do that. So his question is, can you from Microsoft Test Manager run coded UI tests? And yes, you can. If you go into a test case which has been automated, then and go to the test tab, then you can choose to run that, and it will run using the coded UI test. Oh, I'm so sorry, guys. Thank you. It's like I've never presented before. There you go. So if you go to a test case which is automated, which meaning that it has an associated automation like a coded UI test, then you can choose to run it with that automation. And so when you select that test case, you can say run with options. And by default, it's going to assume you want to run that automatically by just launching the coded UI test, which is an opportunity for you to attest as a tester to say, hey, this coded UI test is failing. Let me watch it fail for myself. Or you can say, you know what? I don't trust the coded UI test. I'm just going to run it myself manually. Does that answer your question? Great. Maybe a couple more before we run out of time. Yeah. Great question. Can you use lab management to spin up virtual machines? So we don't have spin up virtual machines in Azure. We don't have the ability for you to do that right within Microsoft Test Manager. So my recommendation is that you use something like PowerShell commands to spin those up. And you may have seen that we no longer charge you for stopped VMs anymore. So that's really helpful for these types of situations. So you could supply your testers with just maybe a PowerShell batch file that you run, kicks off, you know, spins up that virtual machine. Once it's ready, they run all their tests, and then when they're done, run another PowerShell command to stop the virtual machine.
Great.
Yeah, good question. Yeah. Feedback client, yes. Sure. Yeah. So really quickly, I'm not fully set up right now for a demo of feedback client, but basically, it's designed to help you pull in feedback from non-technical stakeholders. And we really wanted to get that information directly into TFS because what we find is that if you're trying to pull in feedback from non-technical stakeholders, they might be in different locations. Oftentimes it's difficult to capture full fidelity information from them. And so what we've done is we've built that right into TFS now. So you can request feedback. What I would do is supply, the name of a person I want feedback to from. They would need to have access to TFS, but they don't need to have a client access license. There's a special security group you add them to. You can add 10,000 people if you want to. We don't care. You specify their name. You tell them where the application is that you want them to test. So maybe staging.fabricam.com. Instructions like log in as test user one. And then at the bottom, you say what you want feedback from them on. So if you're sending this to your lawyers, you might say, did we implement privacy page correctly? And the nice thing about that is that they'll get an email. They can click, if they haven't already, they can click to install the feedback client on their machine, and then they can launch that feedback session. That's going to open up a window similar to the test runner. It's going to capture their experience in the background so they can log a video recording, audio annotations. And it's kind of like that two-way mirror experience where you can, kind of observe your users, but TFS is doing that for you. And when you get that feedback back into TFS, it will look something like this. So when I go to the feedback tab, it will come into a triage area where you can decide, is this new feedback? Do we need to create a new requirement or a bug based on that? So here you can see I have some feedback that came in. And then, if you wanted to include a video or something, you could. When you file that feedback and create a new requirement or bug, the nice thing is that when the developer opens it up, they're not trying to interpret what the user said. They see exactly what the user said in their own words. So yeah, that's the feedback client. I did a foundational session at Tech Ed Europe last year where I show a little bit more in detail that whole experience. Also, I believe that Stephen Borg did a session earlier this week where he shows a lot of those experiences as well. I do believe that I'm out of time. I apologize. I'll stick around for a couple of minutes and then I do have to jet. But my email is brian.keller@microsoft.com. I'd love to answer any questions we didn't have time for.